Welcome to Access Utah. Today on the program, Sherry Quinn talks to local cheesemongers about our addiction to cheese and how to shop for the best kinds of cheese from across the world. At 9:30, Science Questions explores science education through the innovative lens of Native American scientist named Ed Galindo. He is infamous for landing his students' high school science project on the International Space Station. This will be coming up after the news.
Support for NPR comes from Road Scholar, offering educational travel adventures for adults at roadscholar.org. Think outside the tour.
With Utah News, I'm Carrie Bringhurst. Preliminary tests show that there's no pollution in the water near the Holly Refinery in Woods Cross, where a break in a fuel tank sent oil spraying onto buildings, cars, and streets. According to the Utah Division of Water Quality, they found no detectable levels of dangerous chemicals in a first round of tests, but the agency is waiting for more detailed results. The explosion at the Holly Frontier Corporation refinery on August 30th spewed 8,000 gallons of oil into the air as far as a mile away from the plant. The Air Force says one of its jets crashed during a training mission in Utah this May because of an engine failure. Details of the accident were released yesterday. The F-16C Falcon crashed about an hour after takeoff in the Utah Test and Training Range near Salt Lake City. The Air Force says the engine failed because an 8-year-old fan blade broke free, and that caused catastrophic damage. The pilot safely ejected, but the jet was destroyed on impact. The Air Force values the loss at nearly $24 million. Conservation groups contend that the U.S. Forest Service has a duty to ensure that endangered condors and other birds aren't killed by ingesting spent lead ammunition. The groups are suing the agency. They're seeking to regulate lead ammunition in the Kaibab National Forest under a federal law governing the disposal of hazardous waste. Lead ammunition is the leading killer of the California condors. But those working to restore the condor to its historic range in the Southwest say a ban would serve only to create conflicts with hunters. The Arizona Game and Fish Department has been encouraging hunters to use non-lead ammunition in Arizona's Grand Canyon and Utah Zion National Park.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by the Porcupine Music Festival, tomorrow at noon in the Northern Utah's Avon with the Funk of Shaky Trade, Americana, with the Folka Dots, Reggae with the Sarah B. Band, and the World of Music of the World Music of Wade Evans in the Harmonic Conspiracy. Overnight camping is available. More information is on their Facebook page.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. If you want to know what kind of cheese to serve at your next dinner party, listen up. Today on the program, we visit Whole Foods grocery store in Salt Lake City and talk to cheese buyer Andrew Fitzgerald and marketing specialist Lydia Martinez. Andrew has somewhat of an obsession with cheese, and it will pay off at your dinner table.
I eat cheese 5 times a week. And prosciutto if I have it on hand, too. I love cured pork.
And what cheese does that go well with?
Depending on which prosciutto I have, my current favorite thing to eat is, it's actually not prosciutto, but salami. I'm going to plug my friend Cristiano Caminelli, who's a local salami producer. He does small and large format stuff, but Cristiano makes the best salamis I've ever had in my life, and so I love the opportunity to sit down with a soppressata salami, which is the white wine and garlic, and then a piece of the quadrella di bufala, and just sit in the backyard in a chair on the grass, watch my dog be a knucklehead, and just enjoy a little meat and cheese in the afternoon. It's a wonderful thing.
In any type of milk, whether it's mother's milk or cow's milk, there are enzymes that are called opioids, which are related to opiates. There is a lot of value in having a baby mammal addicted to its mother's milk, because you want to make sure that, you know, it's just nature. It's making sure that that baby is going to feed and grow. And that's why it's so hard to wean children and wean animals off of milk because they're literally addicted to it. Now you take that milk and you concentrate it in cheese. It takes way more milk to make, say, like a hard cheese, like a Parmesan, than it does to make a soft cheese. So the more milk that's in it, the more concentrated those enzymes are, and the more addictive the cheese is. So yes, cheese is literally addictive.
Yeah. It's fun. I'll see friends at their jobs update their Facebook page via their iPhone or whatever and say, oh my God, I need a piece of, you know, and then insert whatever cheese right now. And it's always makes me laugh. I'm just like, yeah, I could go for that too.
Well, and it hasn't hurt your figures either, so that's a good selling point too, right?
I gotta ride my bike a little bit more, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but and snowboard more in the winter. But it's good food should be really important to everybody. I mean, that's my opinion at least. When you get into cheese, age is flavor.
There's a very famous cheese quote that says age doesn't matter unless you're a cheese. You really want cheeses aged to perfection for the fullest flavor, and whether that means that it hits its peak flavor at a very young age, at you know, 60 days, or whether it doesn't hit its peak flavor until it's been aged for 2 years, if it goes under or over that kind of key time frame, it's just not going to be as good. It'll still be wonderful, but it won't be as good. And so that's one of the reasons why you really want to go in and get to know your local cheesemonger, because they can tell you this cheese right now is at its absolute peak. This is the best time to buy it. This is the best time to get it. And it makes a big difference.
And can you talk about flavors, and what is it about cheese flavors that are so appealing, and what are the most popular flavors?
Well, flavors will come from like anything from like, you know, like where the milk is being sourced from, and then the cultures that are being added to it will help develop in flavor. How the cheese is aged will take an effect on the flavor of it. Like if you're getting into like a washed rind cheese that has a bacterial rind, those cheeses they're defined by their stinkiness. So like your cheese like Taleggio or a Poisse, ones that kind of smell like dirty socks. With that one, what's interesting, there's two things I find interesting about that. The appeal of that cheese to people is that almost rot and decay kind of smell that's actually kind of good. Then you got to think back to like, well, humans were at one point scavengers, so perhaps that's where it appeals to us. I know that for my friend Matt, a good piece of Taleggio will make him hungry if he smells it, whereas you give that to someone who's more sensitive and not into cheese, and that'll make them lose their appetite. And then the other thing that's interesting too is that the bacteria that is used on these washed rind cheeses is actually extremely similar to the bacteria that's secreted in human sweat. So that's part of why it smells so similar. And it's the same thing. I mean, to some people it's kind of appealing, and some people it's not.
Another thing that very much affects flavor, it's the most basic thing, is what animal the milk comes from. So you have cheeses that come from dairy cows. You have cheeses that come from sheep or from goat's milk. Buffalo milk is another one. And all these different types of milk, they have different milk fat in them. They have different levels of milk fat. They have different flavors. How those different milks age in a cheese also affects it. And then the other thing that really affects the flavor is what those animals were raised on, what they ate. And so milk from a cow that has been feeding in the spring on rich, green, fresh, tender grass, that milk from that animal will taste very, very different when that animal is feeding on things like straw and grain in the wintertime. And so the flavor of the milk from the same animal can vary from season to season as well, and that affects the flavor, the mouthfeel, and ultimately those subtle nuances, the undertones in the cheese.
Another good example would be like Quick's Cheddar, which we carry here, and it's in 2008 it won the Queen's Award for being a wonderful representation of Great Britain. But this cheese has this wonderful kind of sulfury cooked egg taste, which is
part of what you get out of a good, appropriately aged cloth-bound cheddar, where it's actually wrapped in butter-soaked bandages and then aged in that way, as opposed to being vacuum-sealed like you'll get like with your block of cheddar from like Tillamook or whatever. And so the flavors that you get out of it, though, in addition to that, is you'll notice like a really distinct kind of asparagus and then this really great mustardy kind of horseradish finish. And it's, these are all things that are influenced by what the cow's been eating. And so you can eat that and then you can compare it against like Cabot cloth-bound cheddar out of Vermont. And that one's going to have that same great sulfury eggy kind of taste. And then it has this really distinct kind of artichoke kind of flavor.
One of Andrew's favorites is water buffalo milk cheese because he says it is not gamey tasting. Apart from Italy, its birthplace, buffalo mozzarella is made across the world. Countries all use milk from their own herds of water buffaloes. Italy and Bulgaria have the best dairy water buffaloes, according to many scientists.
Gamey is such an off-putting term, though. It's not as free-range tasting. But water buffalo milk has almost twice the fat solids that cow's milk has, so that's going to end up influencing that you're going to get more texture, you're going to get a richer mouthfeel. That's going to be this more kind of enveloping experience with it. And so the cheese that I have been in love with for a while is called Quadrello di Bufala, and it's a washed rind cheese that's made in the Piedmont region of Italy. It's from the neighboring to Lombardy, which is where Taleggio comes from, very famous stinky cheese. It's made in that exact same style, but it's made with water buffalo milk instead of cow's milk, and it just has this different dynamic to it. When that cheese is at room temperature and you pop a piece and you're sitting there chewing on it, and it's just like, it's this crazy, like it envelops your senses kind of experience.
It's very, very rich without tasting sharp.
Yeah.
In any way. So sometimes people don't like sheep's milk cheeses or goat's milk cheeses because they taste a little bit sharper to the tongue, but you don't get that at all with buffalo. Well, you still get the creaminess and the richness that you don't always get necessarily with cow's milk.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you wash rinds. You take the time to do that,
yeah.
Where most people don't. And can you talk about that and why that's important?
Oh, it's so important. When they come in, particularly the Taleggio and the Quadrello, when they come in, they're wrapped in paper. And they're not vacuum sealed or anything, but they're wrapped up in paper. And these are cheeses that have been on, you know, a boat from Italy to the U.S. and then stored for who knows how long. But, I mean, like let's just say at minimum they've been for 3 weeks not getting to be in their ideal environment, which is like a really high humidity environment, like 90%, and sitting at about 50 degrees Fahrenheit. What happens is that the rind on these cheeses are live and active, and they have this wonderful brick orange color to them when they're healthy. And instead, when they get here and I unwrap them, they're covered in fuzzy molds that are not necessarily edible, and the rind is, I wouldn't say dead, but it's dormant. And so what's happening is that the cheese is no longer allowed to develop anymore in flavor, and then also you can't eat the rind. So that's kind of two negatives. And so what I end up doing is I get them in, and then I wash them with a saline solution, so a little bit of salt and water, and make sure that I get into all the crevices and whatnot on the rind and make sure that I'm not actually scraping away the mold, because I'll be taking away the actual bacterial rind as well. By revitalizing the bacterial rind, it actually in turn will kill off the mold on its own. And so what's cool is by doing that, and then I just wrap them in plastic and just put them in my little reach-in cooler so I can keep an eye on them, and I flip them and whatnot. The bacterial rind is anaerobic, so it doesn't need oxygen. And so what's cool about that is that you're denying air to the mold, and then you're also providing fuel to the bacteria. And then the cheese will, as opposed to just sitting there and continue its process of dying and losing moisture, instead it'll continue to develop in flavor and everything. I cut into a wheel of Quadrello like a little over a month ago, and the day that I took it out and knew that it was time to cut into it, I was thrilled because it just looked magnificent. It had this great brick hue to it, and it was, I mean, it stunk through the wrap, and I cut into it, and I had a little piece, and I was just like, oh my God, this is probably the best piece of Quadrello I've ever had in my life. And it was just, you know, and immediately, like, let everybody know that I knew. I was like, you need to come in and buy a piece of cheese from me today. Like, this cheese is unreal. I mean, that's the reason to do it. You want people to be able, like, when they're buying, like, they're paying $22 a pound for Quadrello or $17 a pound for Taleggio, you want them to get their money's worth. So, I mean, if that means a little bit extra work for, on my end in order to provide them with the best product possible, then so be it.
And how important is the packaging and the different, why some are in paper, some are in plastic, some are in tin foil? Or?
Ideally, cheese shouldn't be wrapped in plastic, to be quite honest. It has to be wrapped in plastic here in Utah because of our low humidity. But if you were to go to like New York or whatever, you would find cheese displayed unwrapped. We have to wrap things in plastic in order, you know, to protect ourselves and whatnot, protect the product, but then also to preserve the product. But if you were to buy a piece of cheese, I mean, ideally what you would do is then take it home, and it kind of depends on what kind of cheese it is, but generally if you keep it in like a Tupperware as opposed to wrapped up tightly in plastic, it allows the cheese to not kill itself, because as it sits there wrapped up, it's giving off certain gases and whatnot, and those will... They have nowhere to go when they're wrapped up in plastic, and so that'll actually cause the cheese to spoil more quickly.
Yeah, Tupperware, or you can get like glass cheese domes that work really, really nice, and will your cheese will last almost double the amount of time without molding or spoiling if you're storing it properly, which is not tightly wrapped in plastic. And then the other thing about cheese to keep in mind is that serving it, most cheese is best served and you get the best flavor at room temperature. So a lot of people will pop some cheese out of their fridge, cut into it right away, and then they're surprised that the flavor isn't what they wanted it to be or hope it to be. You know, the real trick is to let it sit out for an hour or more on the counter, bring it to room temperature, and that's when you're going to get your best flavor of your cheese.
You get the right consistency out of it too when you get into those soft ripened cheeses. Like, you want that cheese to be runny. I mean, ultimately, I just want people to come in and if they have questions about cheese or whatever, I want them to go home really excited about what they purchased. I mean, I think that that's the way you should feel about pretty much anything you purchase, is you should be glad you bought it. So, I mean, if that's my goal, is just to have people be happy and then come back. And I mean, I love it when someone comes back and they'll say, "Oh, you sent me home with this great piece of cheese," and I'd be like, "I got a lot of great cheese. Which one was it?" You know, especially when you're enjoying it in the right atmosphere, like it's like a, you know, a nice summer evening, an appropriate cheese to go with whatever your plans are.
Do you have any advice about when to eat cheese? I know the French have it for dessert often, right, or after dinner.
It depends. The having cheese as an appetizer or as dessert is going to base partially on the flavors. Like if you're having lighter flavored cheeses that aren't super heavy palate enveloping flavors, you can have those before dinner. But if you were to start off your meal with a big old hunk of Taleggio, that's all you're going to taste the rest of the night. And then not only that, but it's going to be, while not necessarily offensive to your palate, it is going to be that much more of an intense of an experience just based on the flavor. Like, you're going to be like, "Oh my lord, this cheese is really stinky." But if you have it after dinner when your palate's already full, you're going to be able to have that piece of really stinky cheese and be able to enjoy it more, because it's not hitting a blank chalkboard, I guess, like, and just writing all over it. Like, you've confined it to how much it can actually give you.
And how important is fat content?
Fat's good. Fat's flavor. I mean, there are cheeses out there that are been made for hundreds and hundreds of years that actually have like part skim in them, like Emmentaler and whatnot, or Parmigiano Reggiano actually technically is a part skim milk cheese, just because some of the milk is from the night's milking, and it's allowed to sit overnight, and then the cream is pulled off and used for butter. So in the case of those like hard cheeses and stuff, fat's not necessarily as big a deal, but when you're getting like the soft ripened cheeses and the brie, I think that fat is very important. And when you're sitting there buying, you're asking me for a reduced fat brie, I'm just like, I don't know if you should like, you're not going to be satisfied with it. I mean, that's part of what is with that cheese. Like, you get into, like, a regular brie, it's around 45% fat. You get into a double cream, it's 60%. And you get into the triple creams, they're around 75%. But it's also, what's interesting with that, though, is then it's 75%, but it has to do with dry weight. And since there's so much moisture in it, there's actually less fat in a triple cream versus, like a single cream.
Raw milk is trendier in the U.S. these days, but it is still controversial. Humans consumed raw milk exclusively prior to the Industrial Revolution and the invention of the pasteurization process in 1864. It was first used in the United States in the 1890s, after the discovery of germ theory, to control the hazards of highly contagious bacterial diseases, including bovine tuberculosis and brucellosis. That was thought to be easily transmitted to humans through the drinking of raw milk.
When you get into these cheeses that have been made for 1,000 years or more, that are made with raw milk, I don't know that I'd want to get a pasteurized milk version of it because it's not the real thing. When you're getting into true Emmentaler, that's made with raw cow's milk. And what I like about that is I can say when someone's like, I want a good Swiss, and I'd be like, you want Emmentaler? Like, this is the real deal. This is the original Swiss. It's like, this is the one that you want. And you can point out and be like, it's raw milk. And the reason it's raw milk is because, I mean, pasteurization only happened within, like, the last 200 years. So, tell you what, like, hundreds and hundreds of years prior to that, people were still eating this cheese and they weren't dying. So I think it's okay.
Are there holes in Emmentaler
cheese? Yeah, that's a specific bacteria that's in the cultures that it creates CO2 as it's aging. And so that's what creates they're called eyes. And that's what creates the eyes in Swiss cheeses. It's actually the bacterial activity in that specific culture.
How do you tell when a cheese has gone bad?
Definitely look for an ammoniated smell. That's usually a clear indicator. Discoloration, mold that shouldn't be there. When you're getting into things where, like, there's, like, a little bit of mold on your cheese, you can always cut it away.
The better tasting the food and the better tasting the flavor, I really feel like you eat that much less of it because it's so good and you savor each bite. You know, it's not something that you're just trying to get through. It's something that you're enjoying on a slow and a small scale. And so,
ideally. Ideally, you're not eating a lot of it.
unless you're Andy and his buddy.
That was Lydia Martinez and cheesemonger Andrew Fitzgerald. Thanks for tuning in. Sherry Quinn, Access Utah.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a 2-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. I'm Megan Van Frank. This week, learn how the free public school system was established in Utah in 1890. First this.
The Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council with support from a We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation.
The iconic one-room schoolhouse conjures images of Western settlers struggling to create educational outposts on the frontier. But how did those one-room schoolhouses evolve into the publicly supported education system we have today? Education in the Utah Territory began with schools established by Mormon pioneers in the late 1840s. Schools were run by Mormon congregations or by individuals who opened classrooms in their homes. Each school accommodated only a few students, the curricula varied in quality, and attendance was not mandatory. Some parents encouraged their children to get as much education as possible, while others doubted the need for anything beyond the rudiments. Many also questioned the level of religion that should be taught and who should pay for schools. Newcomers to Utah thought the state of education was inadequate. Starting in the 1860s, Catholic and Protestant leaders established their own schools, both to improve education in the state and, in some cases, to Christianize the Mormon children. As more non-Mormons arrived, a movement grew to establish a system of free public education supported by taxes. Because of the Mormon Church's emphasis on self-sufficiency, its leadership rejected the idea of public schools. They believed families should pay to educate their own children, while charity should help those who could not afford schooling. Some communities attempted to create a tax-supported school system, but faltered when many people refused to pay the tax. Despite these difficulties, loud calls for free public education continued. Utah was the last territory in the nation to provide a free public school system. It wasn't until 1890 that the Utah Territorial Legislature passed the Free Public School Act, which resulted in the creation of compulsory secular schools and the construction of modern school buildings. Many of the schoolhouses built before the Free Public School Act, and as a result of it, still exist and stand as symbols of the early efforts to support education in Utah. Research and writing for this episode of the Beehive Archive were provided by Michelle Hill. Sources and past episodes may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.
Support for Science Questions is provided by the College of Science at Utah State University, where graduates' acceptance rates to medical, dental, and graduate schools exceed national averages. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Science.
Questions.
Radio.
Now give me what I need. Give me what I need. Give me what I need. Give me what I need.
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Sherry Quinn.
And I'm Susie Montgomery.
Once ranked number one, the United States is sliding further down the list of innovative countries. Based on a June 2010 report by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the U.S. is now ranked number 8 in innovation. One way to get back on top, many say, is through science and technology education.
University of Idaho professor and NASA engineer Dr. Ed Galindo has taken science education to astonishing heights. In fact, all the way to the moon. Galindo has had his hands in many pots, to say the least. While he is busy growing an astronaut garden of fish and lettuce designed for the moon, saving beavers' lives through relocation tactics, and developing a very successful streamside salmon hatchery using discarded refrigerators, Galindo, a member of the Yaqui Indian tribe in Arizona, is most passionate about teaching science to young Native American tribal members, such as students from the Shoshone-Bannock Reservation in southeastern Arizona.
I spent 20 years with Shoshone-Bannock tribe. I'm not a Shoshone-Bannock tribal member, but I like to think I've adopted most of those tribal members into my own family. I'm a Yaqui native, and so that's my native heritage, but I owe the Shoshone-Bannock tribe so very much because I got to work with the most precious thing of any tribe, that's the youth, and I built long life relationships with my students that go way beyond the boundaries of the reservation. And after 20 years on the reservation, we see each other, we laugh with each other. I've watched them grow up. Now they have their own families. And I'm going, holy smoke, the circle is complete. And so that's my engagement with the Native community.
In the late 1990s, Galindo was a NASA fellow, and in 1998 was teaching science at Chauvin High School in Idaho, when, in typical casual but bold Galindo style, he entered his after-school science team in a national NASA competition. The winning team would get to fly their experiment on a NASA aircraft. Chauvin's project was mixing fertilizer in space.
This is why NASA and I have this little game, because we had applied on the KC-135, which is a vomit comet. The KC-135, this was prior to 1997, was only for astronauts to train. So this is an aircraft that takes takes flight out of Houston at a Johnson Space Center, goes off the Gulf of Mexico, where the oil spill is now, by the way, and they go up to about 50,000 feet and zoom down to about 20,000 feet, and then they pull up. So it's a huge roller coaster in the sky. From the peak to the valley, if you can imagine that, you can experience microgravity. You can float. It's as close to being in space as you can. So that's called the KC-135. The astronauts call it the vomit comet, because guess what happens on there? Yeah, you vomit. So these applications came out. I was in D.C. at a conference. I'm going, that is so cool. I bet my students could do it. And they go, well, you know, where are you from? And I said, well, the Shoshone Bannock Indian Reservation, on high school. And they go, well, this isn't for high school. These are for colleges. This is their first time. And I says, yeah, we could do it. No, 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 get away, get away. So the guy left for break, and I went back, and I seen the applications on the table. And I'm going, I'm going to take one of these because this is a really good idea. And so I took one, and I told, when I went back to the reservation, I told my students, look, there's this opportunity. I bet we could do it. They go, yeah, but it's for colleges. And I go, yeah, we need to bend the rules because this is a real good idea. So we made this little story that if they came up with a good idea, I'd fill out the paperwork, we'd work together, and we would challenge NASA. And then I would take full responsibility and fill out the form falsely. And they says, all right, what a good idea to get Ed in trouble. I said, yeah. Well, they came and did their part. They came up with an experiment to mix fertilizer in space, which is really brilliant. And we built the machine together. I said, okay. I filled it out. And one of the X's, for example, name of college. Well, our school is called Shoban High School. So I put Shoban Tech. And then I didn't want to put minority on there because I wanted to see if we could win just because of who we are. So I didn't put anything. So I did it. I put our experiment in. Again, this was about 1998. And I submitted it, and I got a call back. Congratulations, you're in the top 200 of the nation. And about 4 months had expired. And I go, well, wait a minute. You know, we're a high school. We're on Indian Reservation. Thank you. I sent a letter. I says, you know, we should be disqualified because we're not, but thank you for selecting. I made my point. You know, we won the top 200. Then another about 2 months go by, and then I get a call. Congratulations, you're in the top 100. I go, wait a minute. Did you ever get my stuff? Oh, yeah. And I said, well, okay. And we went through, and then congratulations, you've been selected to fly your team of 12. I go, who's all in our class? MIT, Texas A&M, Stanford, and Shoban Tech. I go, hallelujah, praise the Lord, we are going to Houston, Texas. And we're all excited, we're getting ready to go. And the night before, it dawns on them that we're a high school from an Indian reservation. They go, foul. And I go, too late, because I gave you notice, I told you this. And they said, well, come down and we'll get this sorted out. So I come down, and then NASA's so tricky. They kind of thought we'd wash out in the briefing. What does that mean? Well, all teams go down, and you go into a hangar, and you're given long tables, and your team breaks down their experiment, clear down to the last screw, okay? Then you have to prove you're safe to the NASA engineers and scientists. So I knew what they were thinking. Well, they're going to wash out there. They won't pass. They go, and they pass that part. And they go, where's your instructor? I was kind of hiding in the back, and they all pointed at me, and they said, come here. So they took me in this room, and there was a NASA lawyer, and they go, look, technically you can't fly because you lied on your application. And I go, well, you guys didn't tell the truth either. And they go, well, what do you mean? And I go, that's called a treaty. And that was a promise that was signed that you didn't fulfill. And they go, well, wait a minute, that's two different things. I go, no, wasn't that a government document? And they go, yeah. Wasn't what I filled out a government document? And they go, yeah. And I lied a little bit, and you lied a little bit. Let's just call it even. And they go, it doesn't work that way, back and back. So anyway, we compromise. John helped us, and we got this director involved. We could fly because we won honestly, and they could see I tried to inform them honestly. And we got to the end, and we passed the oral exam honestly, so they couldn't keep us back. And so then our flyers could fly as long as they were 18. They thought they had us there. Well, everybody was, but our two lead females were 17. And they would not bend that, and I can see, because that's what they have to do. So they help support on the ground our flight. And so because of that, the very first high school flew on the Vomit Comet in 1998. The very first all-Indian team, which did not vomit on the Vomit Comet, and all the other teams did, which really got NASA's eyebrows up. How did this happen? And then we were picked of one of two because they did so well to fly space shuttle out of that, and that started our whole space shuttle career. And the very first Indian experiment made on a reservation flew in 1999 on Space Shuttle Discovery. So because of that, so anyway, I'm proud as heck as those kids, and actually writing a little book about that with some good folks from Utah State. So NASA had not forgot that I had pulled this trick on them. Now if you want to fly on the KC-135, the president of the university has to sign off. So I really pat them on the back that they've learned their lessons well. But still, sometimes we needed to bend the rules. And you may ask, well, why did you really do that? Well, because prior to that time, NASA is such an elitist club. Only short white people with crew cuts could do it. Women couldn't be part of it. Minorities couldn't be part of it. And for sure, heck, high school students They just didn't have that in their mindset. And it needed to be done. And so I don't advocate to your listeners to lie on government forms, because NASA isn't really handy about that, nor do they like jokes being played on them. But on the other hand, I think rules should be bent sometimes when kids are involved and kids have good ideas and when things haven't been done before and people are afraid to think outside the box. I mean, this is NASA, for goodness sakes. They think outside the planet. But they need a little edging, you know? And so I'm always pushing the envelope that way. Well, they push back on my PhD, and now we're even.
Pushing the envelope, yes, and doing so with a contagious sense of humor. And you need to have one of those to think up this one. Galindo and his students developed an experiment to help astronauts combat depression on long-term space voyages. They figured out how to make paint from urine being an abundant resource on any space flight. The idea is that through painting, astronauts will have a creative outlet and avoid boredom and depression. The students' experimental paintings are now adorning the International Space Station.
We take urine, we pull out the urea part, and we have a usable substance that I call space water. What can you do with it? Well, you can grow plants with it on a single pass, or you can paint with it. Again, why would you want to paint with this? Well, because on a long mission to Mars, we think people may get homesick, and they may get depressed. And if they're going to remember who they are as a human being away from the home planet, we think art will help them do that. And so they'll mix up this dried paint with what? With their urine, and they will have fun with urine painting signs. It would be, I think, quite hilarious to paint that on Mars and come back. You know, I mean, it's that alone should put them in a good mood. That alone should put a smile on their faces. What? I mean, you could look at this daily manifest on Mars. Okay, I have to go build the structure. I have to go down and do geology. And then at 10:30, we're going to paint. We're going to have fun with urine. Can you imagine that? I mean, it just be just that alone is just hilarious. So.
Ground control to Major Tom.
You know, humor is part of science, and science should be part of humor, and it shouldn't be so sterile and straight-laced where people can have fun. But it really has scientific merit, and NASA has funded many experiments I've had about this urine. They just didn't like to be called fun with urine. And if you Google fun with urine to this day, it will come up as the experiment. And we've had astronauts go, where's that guy? Because we're asked, what are we going to do with urine up there? We're going to have fun with it. And it wasn't so bad, but it leaked over to the cosmonaut type in Russia. And they also had to answer those questions because they were taking some stuff up. And so it went clear over to Russia. It was so hilarious, you know. So it's those types of games that I've enjoyed my career with NASA. I've been on the ragged edge. And sometimes, you know, they don't appreciate it. But they kind of tolerate me now. So, and we have a good relationship.
You've played tricks not only in space and other planets, but here on Earth, too. Your beaver and the salmon project. Just briefly describe the beaver project and the salmon projects and how you incorporated indigenous science, indigenous thought.
The elders told me one day, and it's true, that the beavers taught the salmon how to jump. And elders are kind of like Zen masters in a way. Is that they'll say stuff, then you have to figure out what it means. And so what that meant is that with beavers building dams, then the riparian zone, the zones on the side, become better. The water becomes cooler. Trees make shade and animals come and nests are made, but the fish inside the water cools. There's more oxygen, and so those become spawning grounds for salmon species and trout as well. Well, when you're big fish, you have to get out. Well, how are you going to get over a dam? Where are you going to jump? So that's how the salmon were taught to jump, because the beavers built those. Okay, so one project we have is the Beaver Project. And here we get calls where beavers are being beavers, and they're plugging up culverts, or they're chopping down a favorite tree that they planted with their grandmother. There's some reason to kill this animal. And we say, wait a minute, there's another way around it. What if we live-trapped them and moved them instead of killing? You don't always have to kill to come up with a solution. And so we work with in our case, the Idaho Fish and Game, National Forest Service, BLM, to take beavers that are in trouble from these lands and take them where people would want them. Well, who would want a beaver in trouble? A beaver with an attitude. Well, a rancher or a farmer or a person that's thinking about, you know, conservation. They like these beavers because they like to see them and they know what they can do. So we find a match and we match them up. But then we ask questions about the beavers. What's your DNA like? What's your health like? How much you weigh? How have you traveled? We ask these scientific questions. And so we blend Western science with a more traditional approach of not always killing. Let's figure out how to move you and save your life and have you as a beaver teach us as a people how to be better. How's that related to salmon? Because they make the water better, they make it cleaner, they make spawning grounds. So we have these little refrigerators, we put salmon eggs in, and a long story short, we have a phenomenal live hatch rate up in the 90s, sometimes 99% live hatch rate of these fish. They leave, they're a natural fish. But the key question to ask is, well, where did these eggs come from? Well, they came from a hatchery, and their parents were brood stock. That means they've never been in the fresh water. They've never left their hatchery environment. Could we take those eggs, take their young eggs and put them in this box, and would their young know how to become a wild fish? And the answer is yes. It took us 10 years to answer that question. Yes, they can. And then go 950 miles from where we place them in Idaho, in the wilderness streams of Idaho, all the way to the ocean and back. And we know that that can happen. And that story, to me, is a miracle in itself, let alone these old refrigerators, let alone Native students making them, let alone Native students become interested in science. Why? Because their elders are interested, because the community is interested, because they bless the boxes, because they say this is a sacred life that you should respect and you should help. And that's an idea of indigenous thought, is bringing the whole community in and the prayers as well. Versus just pure Western science. Well, let's do analysis on the eggs and DNA and then call it good. We say, no, there's a blend. And I think that approach makes a lot of sense, not only to Native kids, but non-Natives as well, I would think. Where's the blend? Where's the balance? Where's the community? Where's the family involvement? If you have family and community involved in what you're going to do, I think you'll complete your project a lot more than it's just fill in the blank, answer the questions at the back of the book, and we'll give you an agreed, says that, gee, aren't you doing good with science? I say, no. I say there's a lot more to it than answering the questions at the back of the book. It's thinking and feeling and touching and getting your feet muddy and your hands wet and mosquito bites on you and on and on and on. That's what science is about, the whole realm.
Galindo is surely onto something when it comes to educating teens in science and finding that balance, that blend between students and science and what is meaningful to a community, seems to come easy to him. Galindo's teaching philosophy proves golden when his teens agree to lugging a huge fish hatching box 10 miles through the wilderness to an Idaho stream.
You just can't say, okay, kids, it's time to carry the box 10 miles through the mountains. They're going to say, what? You know, they kind of sound like a chicken like that. They go, what? Well, they're asking a good question. Well, you got to come with a good reason. And if that box was built with family members, if your grandfather and grandmother blessed it, if they said this is a good thing that should happen, they're not going to question that. And they say, you're young and strong. It's your mission to take it 10 miles in so you can help prevent, you can help learn about life. And the elders are so tricky because with these young salmon, just like young beavers, the learning goes both ways. These fish are, it's a young group of fish working with a young group of people. They learn from each other. They're helping each other live. The fish are teaching the young people about respect and care. And the young people are helping the fish out by learning the same. It's a balance, I think. And that's how that works with not only salmon, but I think with beaver. And I think with learning and respect. Think about this. If you looked at the environment as a relative versus something to be bought and sold and drilled and made money on, I think you'd look at it different, with a different lens. Because that earth is part of you. It's part of your family. These eggs are part of you, as part of your family. These beavers are part of you, part of your family. You're going to look at it different than just a commodity like a beaver pelt, or how much oil you can pump out of the ground, or how much you can sell for a can of salmon. I think it becomes different then. There's passion involved. There's learning involved.
I did want to ask you quickly, though, about the salmon and how you monitored them and the remote sensing and how you did that.
What we wanted to do is paint the boxes. The worst thing you want to have happen is go hiking. You're going to go hiking in the wilderness and come across a avocado green refrigerator or a Harvest Gold. These are so hilarious, these names that come up with the refrigerators. Harvest Gold or an Almond White. But anyway, you don't want to see that. So the kids would paint on them and camouflage. And kids being kids, at first I would watch it, and then I gave them this paint, and I forgot to watch them, and they invite the elders, and they had graffiti on there, and they had other things, and the elders go, what? Here's this chicken word again, what? So anyway, we try to camouflage these boxes. So there's a box out in the wilderness, and in the box are these eggs. The question to ask is, when did these eggs leave? Well, if you're in the wilderness, you have to camp right there, and every day you peek in, and you know when they leave. But if you're a lazy burger like myself, you go, well, I'd rather have my little bunny slippers on and drink cocoa and look on a computer screen and ask computer, when are those fish leaving, Mr. Computer, with my bunny slippers on, drinking my cocoa 500 miles away? And so we ask a satellite, check on that, please. And so we built a series of machines that can look at the box and tell me how much dissolved oxygen is in the water, what the temperature of the water is, and if fish are moving. And a computer, a satellite 280 miles up, can get that data and beam it back to me on my laptop, and I can ask that question, and we can remote sense.
How do you track them from when they leave?
Okay, so a wild fish, if you look at a wild fish in the ocean, let's say you two are on a boat fishing in the ocean, and you catch a fish, and it doesn't have a mark, it has a fin that's not clipped, or it doesn't have any mark on it, then that's a wild fish. If you was to catch it and go, by golly, this fin is clipped here, then that's a hatchery fish. So our fish are wild because we don't clip them. And we don't put little tags in their nose that they can be read on a reader either. They're a wild fish. They're expected to live or die as they see fit. And so they live in our boxes for 61 days. They leave. They live in our area streams for 6 months to a year. And then they go to the ocean and live for another 3 or 4 years, and they come back. Okay, how do you prove that's our fish? That's our second experiment. We think we were put in streams where there were zero fish, so the baseline is zero. So when fish come back, you'd make the assumption that's our fish. When they come as far back as they could the old refrigerator, because that's where they lived, you'd think that's our fish. But do we know that for sure without a shadow of a doubt? The answer is no. So how would we know that? Well, this time we're going to take DNA samples from the eggs when we get them, and when the eggs come back or fish come back, we'll retake those samples, and we will get a DNA match. Then we will know. And so it's a good question to ask that the government's asking. And then we're going to update our satellite viewing. And we think it's a great experiment. We think we can get community involvement, and we want to help the salmon and along the way as well.
And how many eggs are in one refrigerator?
Yeah, it depends. If you have a big old freezer type, you can get 80 to almost 100,000 eggs. A standard little refrigerator will hold 40,000 to 50,000. And we have 20 of these sites out in the mountains of Idaho. The new proposal we'd like to run all the way from our streams of Idaho all the way down to the Pacific Ocean, is, if we could, involve native and non-native communities raising these fish streamside. And so a community would adopt a box. They'd make a box. And they would monitor it, and we would help them. And we think, well, let's just expand this beyond native lands. Let's go to non-natives as well, because we're on this planet together. Let's think about things together, and let's get communities working together.
In order to think about things together, get communities truly working together, and effectively teach students from multiple backgrounds, we need to understand and respect where each of us is coming from, or, as Ed puts it, our spin on life. We asked him to explain how Native or Indigenous students spin differently.
They spin differently because if you're from a traditional family, you don't hear English when you go home. You hear the native language, the native tongue. And in a traditional family, you look at life different. You look at religion different than the dominant culture. You look at stories different. You look at history different. You look at knowledge different. Knowledge I like to call timeless knowledge. Some people call that traditional knowledge. I used to use that term, and then I'd be challenged by the different communities. Well, whose tradition are you talking about? And it's a real good question. You're talking about the tradition of the area tribe. But a timeless knowledge means it's knowledge that they've heard, stories. We've all heard stories when we're growing up, I'd almost bet, about our uncles or aunties or brothers or sisters or mom and dad doing something. It's those type of stories. But these aren't just one generation. They go back 10 generations, 20 generations, as far back as humans can remember of an oral history. That type of timeless knowledge puts students in a different spin mode because they're brought up that way. And then when they're brought to school, if they're used to a very open society, sometimes the societies at school aren't so open. Sometimes they're not so colorful. Sometimes they're like sterile old rooms that aren't fun to be in anyway. And then you're coming from a rich culture of music and sound and life, and you're in a sterile old room. Well, no wonder people aren't learning stuff. You know, that type of spinning we have to be aware of. Run to the desert, you.
the University of Idaho, Galindo is leading an effort to introduce an Indigenous Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math, or iSTEM, graduate studies program aimed at providing accessible, relevant graduate-level education to Native Americans. And its future looks bright. The first doctoral candidate in the program is John Harrington, the first Native American in space in 2002.
He is an enrolled member of an Oklahoma tribe who's getting his PhD with me as a student of mine. John Harrington is an interesting character in his own right. So iSTEM, Indigenous STEM, is about Native thought. And what I want to do is offer as many PhD and master STEMness to Native communities as I can. And imagine a tribal communities that are asking research questions. What type of questions? Well, how pure is the water on the reservation? What about these traditional plants and foods? Do they have heavy metal contamination in them? Who's checking that? So we'd like to build partnerships with these tribal communities and say, look, we'll answer these questions if you partnership. Well, what does that mean? That means you provide a tribal member to help us figure this out. Now, that tribal member may not be thinking about higher education when they begin, but I think if they go through the process and they're trained as a research scientist, they may think about, hey, this isn't so bad, and maybe I'll go on.
And Galindo's sites go far beyond any one tribe.
It's a national model for all tribes, and actually tribes north into Canada and tribes south into Mexico. Well, that's why the word indigenous is so appropriate, because it covers all those native lands and native people from around the globe eventually. You know, there's over 560 federal recognized tribes with 560 different languages and 560 different trains of thought. Those are federal recognized. Then there's unrecognized tribes, maybe 30 or 40, maybe more. And so there's many different communities that we'd like to reach out to and say, look, if you're interested, we'd like to get on this path of the highest degree we can get.
Talking to Ed Galindo is always exciting. He keeps things easy and animated, and while one minute you might be talking about Indigenous doctorate degrees, the next minute, in a light and subtle change of rhythm, Galindo takes you to the moon.
What if you had a fresh salad, an astronaut salad? Wouldn't that be yummy? And they go, why, yes, that would be yummy, and how do we do that? And I said, I got an idea. But what if with your salad you could have a big old nice chunk of fish? I go, oh, that would be great, you know, eating these standard MRE-type foods for 5 years, having a big chunk of fish and a salad, astronaut salad, that would be fun. Well, how do we do that? Well, we could do that if we simulated growing fish on the moon with tilapia, having these tilapia in a big tub, taking that their waste and growing plants hydroponically, and then recycling that back. And so then you have fish and you have plants about 20 meters below the surface of the moon. So we'd be below the surface of the moon in a big rectangular room, blasted out. Okay, why would we be below the surface of the moon? Because of this radiation outside the moon and building structures. It's simpler in my mind to go below the surface of the moon and use the natural cover of the moon to prevent temperature extremes. And inside, you could have an Earth-like environment. What does that mean? You could have lights, you could have heat, you could have power for the pumps. What would power those? Power generators up on top. Nuclear generators, because you don't worry about radiation. So you could have an environment down below. And so these generators would power the pumps, would power the lights and heat. And could you grow food below the surface of the moon? And we simulated everything we could except the gravity of the moon. And we're absolutely sure that we could. Absolutely sure. So that would provide fresh plants for colonists or people moving, and protein as well. My whole niche with NASA has been the food part, because I like to eat myself anyway. And I figured, how are we going to eat? So making food, pulling urea off for fertilizer, and then later on painting with it, fun with urine, which we talked about. It's all about growing food outside our planet. But it also relates to our planet. How? Because of water restrictions that we have. And could we grow the maximum amount of food with least amount of water? We think we could hydroponically. It's an excellent system. So our research has Earth applications as well. NASA really likes that. It isn't just one way. And then thirdly, involve the youth, involve communities to help us grow food, good healthy food, and do stuff with the least amount of water, I think that's a win-win situation as well. Pretty fun.
When do you have time to sit in your bunny slippers?
That's why I need
that's
machines.
The best question.
Yeah, that's why I need machines to help me, because I don't have a lot of bunny slipper time.
And that's a wrap. Thanks for listening.
Special thanks to John Vanderford for making this program possible.
Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery. Science Questions is made possible by a U.S. Department of Labor grant from the Utah Governor's Office of Economic Development and the Utah Department of Workforce Services.
Give me what I need, give me what I need. No, give me what I need, give me what I need. Dear Lord, you show me the best of times, show me the worst of times. Confusion all over my mind, but still I keep busting rhymes. And I fight for what I want, but I die for what I need. And I watch my people bleed while vultures steady feed. We proceed with the mic blessed, fashioned in your likeness, more deadlier than vipers.
Support for Science Questions is provided by Apogee Instruments of Cache Valley, creating innovative sensors for measuring climate change, sustainable food production, and renewable energy. More information is at apogeeinstruments.com.
KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSUFM HD1 91.5 Logan.